Theodore Roosevelt may well be the most remarkable president in American history, not just for what he accomplished in the White House, but for the man he was. A towering intellect, a cowboy, a sheer force of nature. Biographer Edmund Morris says Roosevelt made his mark long before he became president. He told Anne Strangechamps about a few of T.R.'s accomplishments.
After Harvard, he published that historical masterpiece, The Naval War of 1812, and simultaneously he went into the New York State Legislature as a young assemblyman and became minority leader in his second year there. He was then all of 22. After 3 years in the assembly, he suffered a shattering personal tragedy, wherein his gorgeous young wife, Alice Hathaway Lee, died of Bright's disease. And on the same night and in the same house, he lost his mother. The effect of this double tragedy drove him away from the East, away from politics, away from his privileged background, to the wilds of North Dakota, where he became a ranchman. And there, for several years, lived on equal terms with cowboys, building up his body and repairing his soul, coming back to resume his political career at the age of 26, when he married his childhood sweetheart. And then he went on to a series of public jobs, Civil Service Commissioner of the United States, Police Commissioner of New York City. And by the way, while he was doing all this, he was producing book after book after book and child after child. And Assistant Secretary of the Navy at 38, Colonel of the Rough Riders at 39, Governor of New York State at 40, and Vice President of the United States at 41. And then McKinley was assassinated, and he became president at 42. So,
I mean, it's an astonishing record of just, if you just look at his public achievements, but then, you know, you look at the man's intellectual breadth, the kind of things he read and could discuss, it's astonishing. Just about every subject, and he read deeply and just voraciously, and you wonder how he had the time.
I must say it staggers even me, and I've been studying him for all these years. Even while he was president, he read an average of one book a day. He not only read them, he memorized them in large chunks. I tell the story somewhere in the book about him having dinner with his old friend Owen Wister, the novelist, who gave him over dinner in the White House a copy of a new book, 350 pages long, and said, "Mr. President, you really ought to check this out." So Roosevelt took it upstairs at about 10:30 that evening, and when he came down for breakfast the next morning, having presumably slept, he proceeded to recite large chunks of this book to Owen Wister over breakfast. And Wister wrote afterwards, somewhere between his dinner and his sleep and his breakfast, he'd read a volume of 350 pages and missed nothing of significance. The net result of all this reading was, as you've indicated, he was intellectually extraordinarily rich and therefore was able to understand the sensibilities of other countries and other cultures. I mean, he was deeply read in Middle Eastern history and the history of Islam. He read in Italian, he read in French, he read in German.
And he read with the same kind of physical energy with which he approached everything else. You have a wonderful little description of his unique way of reading magazines.
Yes, he had to almost attack what he read. He tore out every page as he completed it and threw it on the floor as though he'd demolished that page and almost physically devoured it.
He also must had what must have been one of the most physically strenuous presidencies ever. You write that he was known to go skinny dipping in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. in the middle of winter.
Yes, he did. He was supremely unselfconscious about his physical activities. He would be seen hanging from a cable over the Potomac, toughening his wrists and swimming naked in the middle of midwinter. And by the way, dragging into the water with him members of the diplomatic corps and members of his cabinet, anybody who was tough enough to withstand this punishment. He moved so fast and he thought so fast and acted so quickly that he seemed to be impulsive. But actually, he plotted out every move very, very carefully with this quick mind, with the result that everything he did turned out to his political advantage.
And also, rather than being somebody who managed to overwhelm opposition through sheer brute force or the power of his personality. He turned out to be a surprisingly sensitive diplomat, didn't he?
Very much so, because diplomacy is the art of dealing with foreign powers and foreign cultures in such a way that their self-image can be protected.
Can you give an example, I was going to ask, of some of his foreign affairs achievements?
Yes. I guess the most dramatic example is the Venezuela incident of late 1902. Remarkable because nobody outside of the White House and the German embassy realized in October, November of 1902 that the United States and Germany were at the point of war. What had happened was Germany had sent in a bunch of its naval vessels into the Caribbean in order to coerce Venezuela to repay some debts which were overdue. Theodore Roosevelt had no problem with that. He felt the nations should honor their debts. But what really upset him was when he discovered that Germany was intending to land forces on the Venezuelan shoreline and appropriate customs houses. In other words, establish a presence on the soil of the Americas. And this, to T.R., was a direct threat to the Monroe Doctrine and the possible beginning of German colonialism in the New World. So he called in the German ambassador and, in dead secrecy, threatened him, in very courteous language too, to make his emperor understand that if he did not withdraw his warships from the Caribbean within 10 days, the United States would use its superior naval forces to blast them out of the water. So the ambassador left town in a desperate funk, incognito in the teeth of a snowstorm, went to New York to the Cambridge Hotel and flashed messages to Berlin. The warships were withdrawn. The crisis was resolved. What is remarkable about this is that nobody outside the White House knew about it. The American people, in fact, remained ignorant of the crisis until long after T.R. had left office. What the episode illustrates is that he understood that Emperor Wilhelm II, the Kaiser, was the most dangerous man in the world. And if he had been seen to be openly humiliated, it would have caused such problems of loss of face that the crisis would have perhaps precipitated an early beginning to World War I.
Was his sensitivity also due in part to the fact that he'd grown up in the social elite, very wealthy, and had, you know, moved amongst the highest circles in this country and even in Europe?
Well, it's certainly true that he knew how to behave in gentlemanly fashion. The word gentleman is kind of archaic sounding these days, but in those days it presupposed a set code of moral conduct. A gentleman always carried out his threats, but his threats were delivered courteously and quietly. In other words, speak softly and carry a big stick. So this code of honor, this code of decency, I think did derive from his breeding. But what saved him from being a snob and an elitist was the fact that the years he spent out west enabled him to understand ordinary working class Americans. Therefore, he became a truly democratic president.
We talked earlier about the level of accomplishment he'd achieved long before he came to the White House. Did he accomplish as much during his two terms in office as he had during the years before his presidency?
It was an extremely active presidency. The only major difference between his presidency and those of the other great presidents we have is that there was no war. T.R. had an almost completely peaceful presidency. But the moral coups that he brought about during his presidency, his busting of notorious trusts, his mediation between capital and labor, his settlement of the Russo-Japanese War, the perpetration of the Panama Canal, and above all, his historic and truly great achievement as the first conservationist president.
These days, one of the things that most people do know about him and remember about his presidency is the sheer number of national parks and forests that he created. Where did that dedication to conservation and the love of the natural landscape come from for him?
I think it comes right from childhood. You know, when he was a baby, doctors predicted that he wouldn't live past his third year. He was so sickly with asthma and a strange intestinal nervous complaint called cholera morbus, plus his scrawny body, that the doctors predicted he wouldn't live beyond the age of 3. And even when he graduated from Harvard, doctors told him that he would have to live a sedentary life and not be active, otherwise he would probably die very young. But the net effect of these frailties and the things he was told caused him to idolize the outside world, to long for the world of action and physical effort. He said to his doctor at Harvard, "I'm going to do everything, doctor, that you've told me not to do. I'm going to climb mountains. I'm going to live in the outdoors. I'm going to live life up to the hilt until I'm 60, and then I'm going to die," which is exactly, by the way, what happened. He died at 60. He therefore spent most of his young years outside building up this body, sucking clean air into his lungs. Anyway, all this was background to the fact that when he became president, he recognized that our environment was deteriorating at a scary rate. Our rivers, even 100 years ago, were becoming polluted. Our forests were in recession. Our national monuments were being abused by mining companies and the rest. So he dedicated most of his presidency to speaking out on the subject of conservation and by executive action, setting aside millions and millions of acres of land for ultimate protection. So I really do believe that this is his greatest single achievement as president.
Edmund Morris, talking with Anstrain Champs. The second volume of his biography of Teddy Roosevelt is called Theodore Rex. He's now working on the final book.